Welcome to this session of the Futures Foundation Futures Forum, and a particular welcome to our audience through Radio National's Big Ideas program. This series, we're asking our guests to address some big questions. And today's session is the first of two consecutive forums on issues to do with population and demography. This month, we're asking where future Australians will live. How will cities cope as their populations increase, and why might Australians choose not to live in cities? Our two guests are very well placed to examine these issues. In the order you will meet them, they are Dr. Alison Taylor, who lectures as part of the City Futures Centre at the University of New South Wales, and who is a highly skilled demographer, having most recently been the New South Wales Chief Demographer, and before that worked for over 10 years in the Queensland Government, spent some time in Canberra, and also worked at one of the largest local government areas in the country at Gold Coast City. Alison provides consultancy services for a range of clients, including the Greater Sydney Commission, the Victorian and AC government planning departments, and private sector organisations, and is the immediate past president of the Australian Population Association, which is the professional association for Australian demographers and population analysts. Our second guest is Professor Neil Argent from the Geography and Planning Department at the University of New England, where he's been since 1996. Neil's research interests centre on the factors and processes that make robust and sustainable rural communities. He's particularly keen on investigating the role of migration, especially city to rural migration and youth out migration from rural areas, in changing the social and demographic makeup of rural communities. In summary, he would say, well, in fact he does, because I got this from his website, that he's a demographer because of his fascination with understanding why standards of living and ways of life vary from place to place. From him, it's critical to know these things before we can intervene to tackle problems like poverty and deleterious environmental change. So I'm looking forward to hearing Neil talk about the rural environment. But first, Alison, what do you have to say about where Australians might choose to live in the future?
Well, thank you, Charles. Thank you very much for the invitation to attend tonight. I think all of us are interested in knowing what the future is going to be like. We all have questions about the future. How many of us will there be? Where will we live? What sort of house will we live in? Will we drive cars? Will we still have children? Will we still need cash? I think most people who think about the future tend to fall into one of two camps. They either focus on doom and gloom, everything is going to be bad in the future, or they're looking through rose-coloured glasses. I tend to be more of the optimist myself, and thus when somebody asks me, is this glass half empty or half full, I might say, yes, it is, but there's room to add vodka. But I'm here tonight to provide you with a realist perspective, and this means that I'm going to focus on some of the facts about where we think people might live in the future. So for those of you who can't see, I'm showing a slide that says, well, actually technically the glass is always full, because it's, even when it's half full of water, it's half full of air. So what sort of things will make the difference to people when they're choosing where to live in the future? I think it really comes down to costs and opportunities. So these things, these costs and opportunities, tend to push and pull us all in different directions. I'll go through some of the things that do push us away from areas and pull us into other areas. But beyond that, I think we have questions about whether anybody can change the trajectory that our cities are heading on at the moment, can anyone save our cities? What are the kinds of game changers that might enter into our world that would make a difference to where we might live in the future? So starting first of all with this concept of urbanisation, which seems to be a runaway train. More than half the world's population is now said to live in urban areas. We hit 50% back in about 2007. In the developed countries, in the developed parts of the world, the proportion is up as high as 78%, and it's just approaching 50% in less developed regions. So why are, by some accounts, more than 200,000 people a day moving from rural areas to cities across the world? Well, I think it's largely due to seeking a better life, chasing money, chasing jobs, trying to improve their lot in life. In high-income countries, 80% of the populations live in urban areas. In low-income countries, it's as low as 30%. So current predictions are that we will have approximately 2 out of every 3 people by 2050 living in urban areas. And some people say it's even going to approach 70%. So what's happening is that we're getting more cities and we're getting bigger cities. So we now have this thing that we call mega cities, which in this case refers to cities of more than 10 million people. Back in 1950, there was only 2 cities of more than 10 million people, Tokyo and New York. Now there's 29. The problem is not that there are this many really large cities or that cities are inherently bad. It's that cities, especially these big ones, are the location of extreme poverty, poor housing, worsening inequality, plus quite unsustainable rates of energy and food consumption and enormous waste generators. Urban areas across the world generate 70% of the world's GDP, consume 60% of the world's energy, and push out 3/4 of our carbon emissions. So the more of these big cities we have in the world, the more we consume. But let's get back to what draws people to cities. There are 2 sets of factors, as I said before, the ones that push and the ones that pull. So let's talk about the attraction factors first. There are a set of things that initially draw people to cities. And then there are a series of other factors that cause people to stay there, to retain them in cities. And these are to do with people's attachment to urban areas. In contrast, there are what we might call repulsion factors that push people out of cities. Now, these things usually take a much longer time to take effect, and they're very much balanced with a kind of inertia about what you're exposed to, what you know, and are very different for different people. So in some ways this depends on what your connections are with family and friends and what your experience is of other areas. So I think it's quite telling that so many people are born in urban areas, spend their whole life in urban areas, and have very little experience of regional, let alone rural areas, so it's hard for them to make a choice to move there. So living in cities is really about opportunities. It's about the jobs that are available there, because you definitely need those wages to offset the high costs of living in cities. And in cities you have more jobs to choose from. You have more opportunities to progress through your chosen career. The second large area of opportunity is in relation to education. So getting qualified to get the jobs that are offered in the city. And often we see, even though we have quite good educational outlets in regional areas, that specific courses are only offered at city campuses. There's also the chance for people to live the life, if you like, to escape from something. If you grow up in a small town or a regional centre, usually you want to get out, you want to get away, you want to sample what it's like to live in the city. Then, as I was saying, there are a certain group of factors that cause people to develop attachments to staying in place. You get the job, where are you going to get another job just as good? You've got the kids in schools, they're undertaking various activities, you don't want to disrupt their lives. You've got family nearby, you can't leave your family alone, especially if they're getting older. You actually have pretty good access to a whole range of services that you might need. And of course, cities offer a very high and intense level of social and economic activity that's very attractive to people. So what pushes people out of cities? Well, I think this is where the costs come in. The costs of housing, the costs of congestion, the costs of crime. Let's just take housing. People react in different ways to the high costs of housing in cities. They will move. They'll move to another location in the city. And we're seeing a lot of this with people moving from the centre to the outskirts to access cheaper housing. They might decide not to move to a 3 or 4 bedroom house on the outskirts, but instead live in a smaller home closer to the centre. So they change their behaviour to deal with the costs of that housing. With congestion, people change their commute patterns. They might switch to trains, which generally run on time. They might include more working at home where possible. So the city does have a higher cost, but some people would perceive that that results in a higher standard of living as well. Of course, the quality of living is all relative, and I'm sure Neil is going to tell us about the very high quality of living in rural areas. So what's driving the growth in our cities? Population growth, of course, results from either an excess of births over deaths and more in-migration than out-migration. So just thinking about Sydney, for example, the indications are that more than half of Sydney's growth is due to migration. But this is actually a very complex relationship that's made up of more people moving to other parts of Australia than move to Sydney, and a lot of overseas migrants moving to Sydney. In fact, 83% of all overseas born in Australia live in our capital cities. And if we look at recent migrants, 9 out of 10 of our recent migrants to New South Wales actually live in Greater Sydney. So while we're getting a strong influx of overseas migrants, other people are actually leaving Sydney. So I'm showing now a map that describes how many people are moving out of the Sydney region to other parts of New South Wales. And in the 5 years to 2011, 49,000 people moved in, but 93,000 moved out, which means that we actually had a net loss of around 45,000 people. If we look at a little bit more at the kinds of people who are moving, it's clear that they are predominantly young people. So now I'm showing the people who are moving into Sydney from other parts of New South Wales, and you can see that for most age groups, Sydney is actually losing people, and it's only for the ages in their 20s and a few that are 18 and 19 that Sydney actually gains people from the rest of New South Wales. At the same time, we're seeing this movement that I mentioned before, where people are moving out of the closer in suburbs to the outer, more greenfield areas. I'm showing a slide here of the net migration for Canterbury, a suburb not too far from the CBD in the south of the city. And for the last 10 years, every year for the last 10 years, there's been a population loss as people moved, more people moved out of Canterbury than moved in to Canterbury to other parts of Australia. However, Canterbury has grown considerably over this period, and the difference is, of course, the overseas migrants who have moved in. So what about regional cities? Let's take Armidale, for example. It certainly offers some lifestyle attractions. There's a lot of cost advantages when you compare Armidale to Sydney, for example. The 2011 median mortgage repayment in Armidale was $1,300 a month compared to $2,100 in Sydney. The median rent in Armidale was $190 a week compared to $350 in Sydney. So there certainly are some cost advantages. And we know there's a university there. So are people moving there? Well, yes, they are. Some people are moving there from surrounding areas, but there are certainly a number of people who are moving out. The other thing to note is that the movement into Armidale is quite age specific. So if we have a look and see what the net impact is of all of this movement, we can see that it's actually only people who appear to be coming in to access their university training for 3, 4, 5 years, and then when they reach that age group of 25, they're out again. And if you have a look where those people are going, they're going to Sydney, to Coffs Harbour, to Newcastle, other larger urban locations. So the people that move around are typically younger people. They tend to move to access education, like we saw for Armidale, or to get those jobs. They tend to have less attachment to places. But of course, other people, other age groups also move. For example, at retirement, people might move to lifestyle locations. And in the past, we've seen a lot of this trend of people moving to the so-called sea change or tree change locations. My observation is that this movement was interrupted by the GFC. And we're just a bit unsure as to whether it's actually returned to the same degree as it was prior to 2008. Then we typically see a further move for the much older people as they return to be near their family or indeed higher order medical facilities. So it really is migration really is dominated by young people, particularly in their early 20s, accessing those educations and job opportunities. So what is it that I'd like to know about the future? Will cities become less livable as their populations grow much bigger? How big will the cities actually grow? Will planning strategies rescue cities? And how does the future look? Now, I just want to say at this point that just because we know what's happened in the past, that doesn't necessarily mean that's what's going to happen in the future. The future is not imposed on us. We can influence it. Let's take a look at Sydney. Greater Sydney has already exceeded 5 million people. Over the next 20 years, it's expected to add another 1.7 million people. That's around 87,000 people each and every year. Another 725,000 homes needed at much higher densities for those people. More roads, more schools, more hospitals, more parks. But of course, what happens in Sydney's future is to a very large degree dependent on what happens with overseas migration. Recent changes to some of the rules around overseas migrants are anticipated to have an effect, but we are unsure exactly how much of an effect that might have. Where will all these people who are projected to come to New South Wales live? New South Wales is expected to grow 2.2 million people over that next 20-year period. That's about, well, it's a bit over 2,000 people each week. And of those 2,000 people, 1,700 will be in Greater Sydney and only 420 in regional New South Wales, if the trends go as the projections suggest. Well, I like to take an optimistic view, as I said at the beginning. We can create a better future for ourselves. We can create more livable, healthy, and pleasant cities. We can, if we want, make our cities more equitable, connected, and make our regions prosperous. Because make no mistake, what happens in the regions is going to impact what happens in the cities. We could have more green, better transport, dispersed jobs, efficient services. We could take advantage of technological advances. They could be good for cities and good for regions. Some of the things might even make it easier for people to live in the regions and still access the kind of lives that they want in the future. I think there are some game changers that will come into play over the next two decades. Things that will disrupt the way that we do things, the way that we currently live. We hear a lot about driverless cars. I'm sure there will be lots of things that we haven't thought about yet that might change the way we live in the future. So I have here a quote that is adapted from something that John F. Kennedy said, which is, "We neglect our cities to our peril, for in neglecting them we neglect the world." But if we want to do something about our cities, there's certain things that we need. We need leadership. We need vision. And just on that vision, I think the more we talk about the things that we'd like to see in our cities, the better we will be at actually delivering those things. We need long-term commitment, not short-term electoral cycles. We need participation from people, and especially young people who are going to be the residents of cities in the future. We need energy, inspiration, creativity, and we need determination to get a better outcome. Now, we've heard lots of words. I can read you something that was from a government policy document. Livable cities are socially inclusive, affordable, accessible, healthy, safe, and resilient to the impacts of climate change. Livable cities provide choice and opportunity for people to live their lives and raise their families to their fullest potential. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? But we've heard lots of words like this, and we haven't seen a great deal of action to date. So, where are we going to live in the future? Most Australians will continue to live in cities, be they capital cities or large or small regional cities. It's vital that we make all of these cities, not just the capital cities, the best we can. This is one of the biggest and most important challenges of our time, and absolutely necessary to ensure our future. Thank you.
Alison, thank you. We're going to try some applause. Neil.
Thank you, Charles.
Charles, as well, for the invitation. As Charles has said, I'm a human geographer, which means I'm just really interested in the relationship between people, societies, and the places and the environments that they live in and create. So I'm talking about essentially the non-metropolitan areas of Australia and what populations will look like in the future. But the perspective that I come at it from is the fact that because human societies interact with their environments in such a way, these are somewhat path-dependent processes. So to understand the future, we need to understand the past and also the present as well. Okay. So the one thing that I would begin with, I guess, is saying that given, as Alison said, we've been predominantly a urban society for such a very long time, we have decreasing numbers of people who actually have an understanding and experience of rural Australia, that rural Australia is subject to a lot of popular assumptions. I didn't say myths, because some of these assumptions actually are factually correct, and I will bear these out as I go through this particular presentation. But some of these assumptions are that rural Australia is basically full of declining populations and very sparsely settled populations, lots of distances between towns, very low population densities, that lots of the population lives in what are effectively dying towns. The country town in Australia, much famed throughout its history, is effectively becoming endangered and in some cases extinct. And we've seen the loss of services in many country towns, which I guess underlines that whole process, bank branch closures, tractor dealerships and the like that have gone out of business over time as well as populations have moved away. There's also a popular assumption that rural Australia is full of very old populations, and that as part of that process, this process of the loss of youth to go to university and drawn to the bright lights of the cities, as Alison pointed out before, that these places are lacking in dynamism if you put together the ageing population and the lack of youth population in these places. But what I would argue, this is a theme I guess that I'll run through this presentation is something, I guess, that I believe in a lot and I have researched in a lot, is that rural Australia is really a mosaic of land uses and of social and economic landscapes, and each of these different zones, if you like, each of these pieces that make up the mosaic has its own demographic trajectory. And so therefore to talk about the future of the population of non-metropolitan Australia is not to tell a single tale, but to tell many different tales and variations on a particular theme. So before we do that, what I wanted to do is just say a little bit about some of the key characteristics of the non-metropolitan population of Australia at the moment. So when I'm talking about non-metropolitan, I'm talking about all of the areas outside of the capital cities of Australia, of which rural is only one component. So with these characteristics, you'll see they refer to particular settlement zones which are drawn from the Accessibility and Remoteness Index of Australia, put together by the University of Adelaide. So you see they have five key zones in the major cities: the inner regional areas, the outer regional areas, the remote and the very remote. And the key thing about this is that we have very different indicators or incidence of indicators for each of those settlement zones. So of course, to begin with, the Indigenous population, it makes up 2.4% of the national population, but it makes up 3% of the inner regional population, 6% of the outer regional population, and 15% of the outer of the remote population, and 49% of the very remote population. So a positive correlation there between levels of remoteness and Indigenous population. In terms of the family household structures we see across non-metropolitan Australia, these tend to be similar to the national picture, except in the remote and the very remote areas we tend to see more single parent and multi-generational families, largely because of the high Indigenous population. And we tend to have larger households as well in the more remote areas as well. So it's a very heterogeneous area outside of the capital cities. Age structure, I was talking about the ageing of the population, rural Australia being thought to be an ageing population, and that's borne out by the statistics. So one particular measure is the measure of old age dependency, which, as I've said there, is the ratio of the population aged 65 and over, the retirement years, as a proportion of the 15 to 64 year olds, those deemed to be actively in the workforce. And we can see that the age dependency ratio is 19% in the major cities, goes up to 24% in the inner regional areas, 21% in the outer regional areas, then begins to drop away as we move into the remote areas, which again is where we have these high Indigenous populations, where we have relatively high levels of fertility and much younger population structures, age structures. In terms of poverty, we have higher levels of poverty, slightly higher levels of poverty in rural and remote areas, higher in the remote areas, not surprisingly. But we see, as an example of socioeconomic well-being, we see higher rates of homelessness in rural areas, even though, of course, the numbers are much higher in the capital cities. So rural Australia, even though we think about, as Alison was talking about before, these lower costs of housing and easier access to be able to schooling and being able to go to the school assemblies and the like, it's not all beer and skittles out there in non-metropolitan Australia. In terms of education, a really important indicator of the current and the future social capital of the society, we can see here one indicator is young children that are developmentally vulnerable, and we can see that in the major cities we have 11, that indicator is 11%, it goes up to 12.5% nearly in the inner regional areas, up to 13.8% in outer regional areas, and then to 17% in remote areas, and escalates to over 30%, nearly a third of young children in very remote areas. So again, a positive correlation between levels of remoteness and children being developmentally vulnerable. So that's a bit of a snapshot, as I say, of some of the key indicators of the Australian population, just of the non-metropolitan population, just some selected characteristics. In terms of the change that's been going on in non-metropolitan Australia, again, it's been a very mixed bag over time and space. So what this graph is showing you is overall population change from the 1911 census all the way through to the 2011 census. We have the total Australian population in black, a trend line there. And you can see that at least for the up until the 1970s, Australian population is growing at a much higher rate. These are rates of change between those intercensal periods, between each census year. You can see the total Australian population growing much quicker than the total non-metropolitan population, which includes the rural areas and the major regional cities like Newcastle and Wollongong and Geelong and the like, and then going, of course, much faster than the total rural population. We see the total rural population decline very, very significantly in the post-depression and into the Second World War years, then rebounded somewhat. And as Alison pointed out, in the years, not through the 1970s and into the 1980s, we had this phenomenon called counter-urbanisation, or the population turnaround, in which relatively large numbers of people left capital cities and moved into rural areas. It was a period of time recognised across the globe as a phenomenon seen in most Western societies in which people left the cities in large numbers and moved into rural areas. So populations in cities declined, populations in rural areas increased. But you can see there that from the 1990s onwards, the phenomenon really drops away, and from the mid-1990s through to the present, we're still seeing population decline in rural areas. The success story there, of course, is the non-metropolitan areas, which of course includes these some of the regional cities that Alison was talking about, and places like Newcastle and Wollongong and the like. So that currently the national population and the total non-metropolitan population are basically tracking each other. And that, of course, is part of this process that Alison was talking about before, that is urbanisation. So non-metropolitan Australia still growing quite strongly, and up there with the national level, rural areas though not doing so well, not surprisingly. And this map of total population change from 2010 to 2015, this map in many ways reflects what's been going on in metropolitan and non-metropolitan and rural Australia for the last 20 or 30 years or so. So those remotest areas, those areas most dependent on so broader agriculture, population experiencing substantial population decline. Those areas more accessible, closest to the capital cities or located around a regional city, have been experiencing the most rapid rates of population increase. And that includes areas located around major tourism destinations as well, like along the Murray River, for example, the Margaret River in Western Australia, and the like. Some rapid growth in remote areas where there's been indigenous population increase off of a low base, but also, of course, mining and energy exploration as well. And one of the success stories, and Alison referred to this before, one of the success stories of non-metropolitan Australia over the last 30 to 40 years has been these regional centres. And this graph is just showing you some work that myself and some colleagues have been working on recently, including Peter Smales and Trevor Griffin and myself, and it's showing you the growth of six regional centres from across South Australia, Victoria and New South Wales. Their rates of population growth standardised to one in 1947. You can see that every single one of those centres has grown faster than the national growth rate, except for Mildura during the 1960s and 1970s. In 1947, not one of these places had a population of 10,000, and not one of these centres held more than 20% of their regional hinterlands population. But by 2011, each of them had grown between 3 and 5-fold to their current level, and held something like 50%, 50% of their hinterlands population. So again, reflecting the point that Alison was making before, that the urbanisation of the Australian population. And by contrast, we have here the rural population, that part of the population not living in the country towns and their fortunes, and you can see that each one of these hinterland areas, the rural population of these hinterland areas is very much experienced very much below national rates of population increase. In fact, two or three of them are now experiencing long-term population decline. And of course, a key factor associated with this process of decline is decline in agricultural jobs. In 1947, something like 41,000 workers across these regions worked in agriculture, and that grew to 42,000 by 1981. But since that period of time, there's been something like a 40% decline in agricultural work across each of these six regions. So there's been a massive loss of jobs in agriculture, but to be fair, at the same time, there's been a greater increase in service-level jobs. So to replace those agricultural jobs, this is the key point. Those service-level jobs have gone to the regional centres or to within 100 kilometres of the regional centres. So there's been a centralisation of the population. There's also been this massive loss of agricultural work and a centralisation of the service employment that has replaced that agricultural employment. And that, of course, the loss of agricultural jobs is related to processes that are fairly well known. Long-term decline in Australian farmers' terms of trade, so the index of prices received by farmers for their produce as against the prices they pay for farm inputs, and that's been a long-term decline, particularly through the 1980s and 1990s through to the present time. And farmers are always competing against that decline in terms of trade to stay in business, and as part of that process they invest in technology, they lose labour, and of course they buy the neighbour out. So the long-term trend there as well, of course, despite changing the definitions of farms, has been a decline in the number of farms. And that, of course, leads to this process of the long-term decline in agricultural jobs shown in this slide. But at the same time, it's part of this structural change in the Australian economy and increase in services. But as I just pointed out, the service jobs that have come into these regional areas have predominantly gone to the regional centres and not to the smaller country towns, and certainly not to the far-flung rural areas. Now, of course, one of the key processes driving population change, as Alison has pointed out, when populations change by natural increase or decrease or by net migration, and fertility is generally higher in rural areas than what it tends to be in metropolitan areas, and most of rural Australia is still experiencing natural increase, though there are some areas that are now falling into natural decrease. But the big driver, at least over the last few decades, of population change in non-metropolitan Australia has been migration. And this is just showing the process of net migration and the incidence of net migration across New South Wales for one of the most recent intercensal periods, 2006-2011. And you can see on the left-hand side here, the hatchet here, very dramatic losses of people, predominantly the young, as Alison pointed out, and overwhelmingly, spatially, the pattern is massive losses from effectively west of the divide. Some net migration gain along the Murray River for tourism and retiree purposes, but the gains are very much concentrated along the coast, into the Hunter Valley, around the Sydney Basin, and of course up into the mid and far north coast, and a little bit onto the Tablelands as well, Inverell and Armidale and Gyra, which Alison referred to before. And the same story with net migration rates. So a very starkly zonated story there of net migration change, which has been pretty much replicated across Australia over the last 20 to 30 years. And as we've already pointed out, very much driven by the net migration loss of young people. And that, of course, drives the ageing process as well. So to tell a more positive kind of story then of change in rural Australia, that's a fairly stark story. One of the things that we've been working on following international trends is the movement back into rural areas by people living in capital cities. We saw in a previous slide how there was this rebound in the rural population during the 1980s and 1990s from this process called the population turnaround or counter-urbanisation. And these people tended this process tended to affect particular kinds of locations, so those areas in the peri-urban fringe with the most accessibility to the city or along the coast. It's also been recognised internationally that there are other areas, other non-metropolitan areas that city migrants tend to like. Mountainous areas, areas that offer good recreation, views, inspiring landscapes and so on and so forth. And so this map is showing you the expression of this item called the amenity principle, which is an index, as I said there, based on a suite of environmental and historical factors, but also including a measure of accessibility and tourism employment. And the amenity principle is really meant to encapsulate the relative attractiveness of rural areas to potential in-migrants. So it's rural areas being revalorized, if you like, rather than as sites of production, but more as sites of consumption. And the amenity principle, as we've used it, explains two-thirds of the variability in the migration across rural regions, across that period of time. So there's something about this combination of environmental and historical factors, attractive main streets, the accessibility to large regional centres or to the capital cities, and the tourism potential of an area that brings in migrants from city areas. And it's not just for the world to do. The research shows that, particularly because of land prices in Australia, as Alison was pointing out earlier before, the relative cheapness of housing in rural Australia as well, that this amenity migration process is available to a range of different social classes across Australia. And this has been capitalised upon by a range of private and public sector organisations trying to promote the attractiveness of living in rural Australia. So a range of decentralisation programs, unlike the old forms of state-led decentralisation programs, these initiatives are really more about effectively marketing exercises. So we have on the right-hand side in the Evo Cities campaign, which the Evo is an anagram of energy, and vision, and opportunity. And you can see the imagery there that's promoting that people living in capital cities don't have a particularly happy life, according to the top slide, relative to people living in rural areas. And of course, the reason is, as Alison's already said, it's relative housing unaffordability in the capital city as against rural areas, and it's the fact that you can spend much less time commuting to your job if you're living in one of these Evo cities. Seven Evo cities in New South Wales are Albury, Wagga, Bathurst, Orange, Tamworth, and Alameda. And this is the quality of life that they're supposed to offer. All the trappings of city life in terms of cultural life, education, employment, but with none of the hustle and bustle. And that in itself has spun off a small cottage industry of retirement advice for people looking to leave the city and to retire elsewhere. Overwhelmingly, the destinations in this where to retire in Australia are non-metropolitan and are certainly also quite rural as well. Okay, so thinking about the future, what is rural Australia or non-metropolitan Australia going to look like? Will it be able to attract this growing population that is coming into Sydney overwhelmingly from international sources, as Alison's already pointed out? And returning to my opening, I suppose, I'm going to take an optimistic picture to tell an optimistic story, as Alison herself has taken, and say that rural Australia is not one and differentiated mass. It offers a mosaic of contrasting fortunes, opportunities and challenges. What we will see, I think, across non-metropolitan Australia is this process of urbanisation increasing, so growing numbers of people living in towns of various sizes, but increasingly in those major regional centres. We'll see ongoing population growth in the more accessible zones, particularly those that express high amenity, overwhelmingly through migration, but also through natural increase. So I think that natural increase is going to be a declining source of population increase. In the more remote zones, there's going to be an ongoing battle against population decline and the vicious spiral of decline that goes along with that process of population decrease. Decreasing numbers of population, decreased rates of income, decreasing number of children going into schools, and declining customer base, and so on and so forth. And all these processes feed on themselves to lead to further ongoing population and economic decline. We're going to see, I think, across non-metropolitan Australia, continued ageing. And a lot of that ageing will be in place, and it'll be fed by aged in migration, particularly in those more accessible zones. And we're also going to continue to see, I think, youth migration loss, which feeds into this process of structural ageing. So the question then is, can we replenish rural populations, and can we make them self-sustaining? Can we bring in people from the cities to bolster these rural populations? I guess one of the key questions, one of the key issues about this is, can we stop youth net migration loss, or youth net migration loss, which Alison showed so vividly in her presentation. And I guess the question is, do we want to go to stop that process of net out migration of the young? Can we stop it? In many respects, we can't really stop it, and if we could, would we really want to? One of the things that I would argue is that for those younger people who don't necessarily want to go to university or see their future there, we need to be able to offer training and employment for those people as much as possible locally. But for those who want to leave and go to university, I say that we need to make rural communities that they came from vibrant and vital places, so when they do want to return and maybe come back and have their own children and raise their own children close by their own families, they're places they want to return to. One of the, as Alison pointed out herself, the reason why people move to places is because of employment reasons. What we have in many areas, particularly in the more remote areas, we have key industries such as agriculture that are technologically at the cutting edge, but the problem is, of course, that means they're losing employment. So then the question becomes, where there is demand, we have these lumpy demands for labour, can we rely on a local labour force, or do we bring in short-term external labour? One of the problems we're seeing in many rural areas is a lack of capacity to develop a local employment market. There's not enough young people remaining in local areas to form a local labour market, which is increasingly why farmers are using short-term labour from overseas. Can we sustain this over time? Do we want to sustain this over time? Given that rural Australia is experiencing this ageing process at a faster rate than the national average, can rural communities get on board and use ageing as a growth industry through retirement homes, chronic aged care and the like? There are some examples of places such as Inverell and Coolum that are doing it, and doing it with some success. But of course they need the education and training to go along with that to make it successful. And one of the other things I think that needs to be looked at is fostering entrepreneurialism, bringing on the next wave of entrepreneurs through investment in training and education. So it's not just about buying in jobs through smokestack chasing and the like. Processes and initiatives that haven't worked well in the past. In terms of what these places are going to be like to live in, we need to ensure that we're building social capital at the regional and the local scales, keeping important social and sporting organisations alive as much as possible, because these are the networks that keep places thriving and make them attractive to people both living within them and wanting to live in them in the future. And as returning, in many ways, to what Alison was talking about, you know, major cities like Sydney and rural, non-metropolitan areas and rural regions need to be seen as part of the same settlement system and the same polity and the same economy and social system if we are all to thrive and benefit as a nation.